You see, I had an intro to this week's podcast, but unfortunately, it got super clipped. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. It's just that easy. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 641 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Glad you could join me. And wow. After all the hype, all the drama, all the regulation changes, all the fears, all the scaremongering, it's here. It's finally happened. We had the first weekend of the 2026 F1 season, the first under a new regulation set, the first of a brand new era, and boy was the reaction mixed, to say the least. A lot to break down, a lot to discuss, a lot of seeing the field where it was, a lot of tricks, ins and outs. So let's skip a lot of the nonsense, just to let you know, Cam is recovering. He's a little bit on the ill and tired side, so it's just me and RJ O'Connell this week. Hello, RJ, how's it going, mate?
What's good? You know, as some people would say, Ferraris are red, Williams are blue. Is this what we want Formula One to be? Mercedes 1-2.
It rolls right off the tongue. yeah, a Mercedes 1-2 finish, which for a lot of people, they're currently giving it the I told you so. Sadly, Cam Buckley is not here this week. Otherwise, he would have absolutely rubbed our faces in it without any shadow of a doubt. But yes, it was, as the form book suggested, a 1-2 finish for Mercedes, as well as Charles Leclerc on the podium. Max Verstappen down in sixth. But the way we got there was certainly wild indeed. So we'll be talking a little bit about that, about the regulations, first impressions in general. Oscar Piastri, who continued the Australian curse in a very creative and newfound manner. Ferrari and another, shall we say, minor haunting on this occasion. It's nowhere near as bad as it's been in some instances, but it's still a bit of a haunting. Red Bull and McLaren, where they fit in. A very good debut for Audi, sort of. And for Arvid Lindblad, Britain's youngest ever Formula One driver, got off to a flying start in Australia. And yet more mess coming out of Team Silverstone. Oh, boy.
All the mess that we didn't get to on our last episode, previewing the Formula One season, because, yes, there is more carnage to look at when you stare at the multi-car pileup on the other side of the freeway.
And this was before they'd even turned a wheel in anger. Trust me on this. Like, I was editing that episode as the first day press conferences dropped, and I was like, motherfucker, it's happened again. So more of that over the next hour or so. It's going to be a hell of a recording, folks. So strap in and buckle up. But before then, places you can find us real quick. We are on youtube.com/motorsport101. You can check out full episodes of the show on there, as well as video highlights. If you want more video highlights and bonus videos from your boy, you can do so there, as well as Instagram and Motorsport101 Pod and our TikTok page, M101_podcast. If you want to follow us on personally on social media, you can on Blue Sky, Dre Harrison, bsky.social, RJ O'Connell, bsky.social, CBuckley917 is his username on both Blue Sky and Twitter. We're also the podcast is also on there as well, at motorsport_101. You can check out our blog, motorsport101.com, over on there. We've got full written reviews of everything that happened in Australia and in IndyCar second round of the season, the Grand Prix of Phoenix. We'll talk about that on our next episode as we do the IndyCar story so far episode, as we bring together St. Petersburg and Phoenix into one fell swoop. It's going to be a fun time indeed this week, let me tell you. Right, and if you really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded. We have a stacked audience room this episode. Holy hell, Ed, Kira, Max, Jason, Thanks everybody for joining and watching along. Hope you guys enjoy the show. You get a shout out too when you first become a brand new backer. And don't forget as well, if you the sort of person that prefers to be a Patreon backer long term, you can do so at 30% off for a whole year. It's basically 12 months for the price of 9. What's not to love about that? So if you're the sort of person that likes to spend their money in one big hit, you've got the option for you, and you can save a little bit too. And don't forget, you can also join the page for free. If you do it for a month, you can get 25% off after the first month. Just saying. Oh, and as Max quite rightly points out in our chat, serious note, do it on Patreon's website if you're going to do it. Don't do it via Apple. That money does not go to us. They will tax the shit out of you. Not worth it. Take it from me. Right, now that the housekeeping's out of the way, let's get into Formula One's 2026 Australian Grand Prix.
After all the drama, all the regulation changes, and all the hype, the 2026 Formula One season began. New light bots, new ways to disappoint yourself if you're a backer of Alex Dunn in Formula 2. And it began at Albert Park, Australia. And it started with a shocking Saturday. And no, that's not just because of anything that happened in the lower categories or in supercars. Kimi Antonelli had a huge wreck in FP3 just before qualifying, faced a race against the clock just to make it to qualifying. There were just minutes left in Q1. Andrea Antonelli didn't look like he was going to get there. And then Max Verstappen's rear axle completely locked up, and he spun into the turn one wall, bringing out a red flag, making sure that the four-time series champion would start near the back, and it gave Mercedes enough time to get Kimi back out, and he'd eventually progress through every stage of qualifying and qualify second behind teammate George Russell, who got pole position, half a second up on Antonelli, and 8/10 faster than any other non-Mercedes car. Third place was Ajit Kadra's Red Bull. In the race itself, we had a very explosive back and forth between Russell and Ferrari Charles Leclerc. For the year, Leclerc got a monster start, but when Kadra's Red Bull suffered a power unit failure, the field all came on in the virtual safety car, except for the two Ferraris. Leclerc tried to chase the Mercedes down on the tire offset, but Mercedes always had it under control after that. En route to a 1-2 finish for Russell and Antonelli, Leclerc beat teammate Lewis Hamilton over the line by just half a second for third place. And if you're wondering what became of home hero Oscar Piastri, he crashed out on the reconnaissance lap. We'll get to that later. We'll talk about all the main players in a bit. But, Dre, I think we learned a lot about Formula One fans. I think we learned a lot about what Formula One fans feel is the chief value proposition of the sport, or at least what they think it should be. I'm going to ask you, did you like the race?
I thought it was a pretty good race. I enjoyed it. And look, I need to make a couple of hot takes here. First and foremost, Australia gets a bit of a reputation because people are happy to see it as a season opener. I think as a racetrack, I think it races a lot like some of the other street circuits we go to. It can be a little bit of a one passing lane kind of track. It can be a little bit stuffy to overtake around. So I think Australia sometimes dines out a little bit on that sort of pre-season excitement that we naturally have going into a new calendar year. And that's understandable. Like, this was very much a tale of two races for me. I think the first 13, 14 laps, when it was Russell and Leclerc going back and forth, I thought that was great action. I loved it. I was like, this is great. When was the last time Australia saw that many overtakes?
Like,
and genuine back and forth racing where it's like, okay, I'm going to dump my battery here. Charles is like, hey, I'm going to dump my battery over here and I'm going to counterattack you immediately and take back the lead, even though it's going to cost me time. And we saw parts of the track being used that we don't normally see passing. Turn one is not normally a passing opportunity in these Formula One cars. Turn three is a log shot passing opportunity if you get a perfect run. We saw passes into turn 10, passes into turn 12. We don't normally get those in Formula One. This is with Australia being a 4 RS track. in the old regulation set, and they still weren't able to get a lot of passing.
A track that was modified, by the way, to accommodate more DRS passing from a time gone by. Now, I watched this race with somebody that doesn't normally watch Formula One. I can tell you that the two of us were both very pleasantly surprised with the amount of action, because this almost never happens at the start of a Formula One race, right? All the action happens on the first lap, the second lap, and then we're kind of done, especially at a place like Australia, where after the round of pit stops, we experience what I like to call post-pit clarity, where everything just kind of settled down. But I mean, Dre, it started in qualifying, where people's reactions to the amount of lift and coast and battery management during qualifying. NASCAR people said that Formula One just had their Car of Tomorrow moment. And if you don't know, that was when NASCAR introduces the Car of Tomorrow. They're very proud of this thing. They say it's safer. It's supposed to make everything more competitive. Kyle Busch wins the very first race with the Car of Tomorrow at Bristol Motor Speedway in the spring of 2007. And the first thing he says is that this thing sucks. And you look at qualifying and you think, man, these drivers really aren't pushing all the way. Is this what we want Formula One to be? Because for a lot of people, Formula One is all about the best drivers pushing themselves to the limit. 10 tenths, flat out. This is what the sport should be to them.
Without realizing that this is the 76th year of Formula One as we know it, and it's always been a technical engineering sport first. I don't know what changed over the last 75 years or when we really started to think in this. And don't get me wrong, I'm not necessarily saying that the people are wrong to think in this way. What you enjoy about the sport is ultimately your choice. But I need to be the glass of cold water to pour on this bonfire to say, this has always been a really technical sport. This has always been an engineering sport first. And Formula One rarely acts with the show being the number one priority. It often has to compromise to try and make it more of a show, like Australia having four DRS zones in the first place. But there was always a fear this was going to happen. I mean, again, if it depends on how much you follow the sport, but this was talked about a lot during preseason testing in Bahrain, where there was a threat of what we now call super clipping. For those who don't know what that is,
enter the vernacular.
Yes, it's super clipping. Long story short, is basically bouncing off the limiter a little bit, skimming a little bit of top speed off the car, downshifting a little bit, bounce off the red line, and that creates a little bit of extra regen over the course of a lap, because you can't just dump the entire battery over the course of a full qualifying lap and still have charge in it by the time the lap is over. So to increase efficiency, you have to kind of bounce it off the red line. And the biggest example of that was the run to turn 10 off the back of that really long straight. We now have to start sector 2. George Russell, there's clips around in his qualifying where he skimmed like 50 kilometers of top speed off the top of the car by the time he gets to turn 10 via lift and coast. Now, I get it. If you're a hardcore F1 fan and you see lift and coast in a qualifying lap, to a degree, I can understand why that might incense you. Because it doesn't fit the vibes of F1. We want, a lot of people do want to see these dudes push flat out, but the reality is that is now going to be what pushing flat out is all about. It's going to be about battery efficiency and deployment. That is a big part of what this sport is going to be. Now we're at a 50-50 ratio between internal combustion and electric motor power. It was 20-80 beforehand. It's now going to be 50-50. And if you're going to rely on that much more battery power, as well as getting rid of the MGUH, which was a big supporter of this ratio mentality, and now where you're getting rid of a turbo, you've got to spool these cars up yourself on the grid, etc. And, you know, you're taking away a degree of efficiency. This is what it's going to have to be. And it goes into what I've always said. This is an engineering sport, first and foremost. It always has been. So for me, I'm personally not that bothered, because I'm at peace with the fact that knowing that this is what Formula One's always been, even if it doesn't suit the vibes of certain elements of the fan base who think.
But Trey, we grew up in the era of Schumacher, Raikkonen, Montoya, high revving V10 engines, refueling, flat out pushing during a tire war. I mean, we're spoiled. And you know the impression I got from all these years of watching, because that was also the first time I was exposed to the internet, which was a big mistake. I was exposed to a lot of people that said that this was awful in its time. It's a perpetual thing. Your favorite era of Formula One is always going to be the era of Formula One that you first grew up watching.
I think it's the old phrase I've used before in this show. We glorify the past, we nitpick the present, and we get excited about the future. That's how a lot of us get down as Formula One fans. And I'll be completely frank with you. Not every V10 era race was a classic by any stretch. I know people that have ripped entire stints of Kimi Raikkonen on YouTube putting down 20 qualifying laps in a row, and I'm like, this is boring as shit. Like, I'm sorry, it's not exciting seeing one guy run hot laps 20 times in a row. Like,
especially if your guy isn't winning any of it. And I was not a Michael Schumacher guy coming up, so that was very often in the early 2000s.
I will spoil. I was a Schumacher guy, and look, I'm not gonna sit here and lie to you and say that like all 50 plus of Michael Schumacher's Ferrari wins are all automatically captivating. You enjoy it more because you want to see a man win the race. Uh-huh. Of course you do. But I'm not going to sit here and lie to you and say that all of them were classics and that these are all must-watch races that are worth buying an F1 TV pass for. No. Like, it's like what we value and what we enjoy changes over time. That is certainly... Like, if we had V10 era racing now, we would hate it. I guarantee you. Because we'd be saying, why are they cutting grooves in the tires? Why are they not rocking 1,200 horsepower? Like, why can't they pass each other? And why do we have refueling? Because, like, your favorite era wasn't perfect either. And for me personally, this whole talk about, all this management sucks. My response to that has always been, there's always been car management in Formula One. It's just we talk about it a lot more now because it wasn't sexy to do so in the 70s and 80s. Like, Martin Brundle's been that person that's spoken out about this a lot, saying, look, and when I was racing, we were constantly managing the tires, the brakes, the suspension, because the attrition rate was so much higher. So we had to make sure our car got home in one piece first and foremost, right?
And I find that incredible that take comes from Brundle, who has seen it and lived it. Meanwhile, you've got guys our age and younger, some of whom work in the business, some of whom just have a lot of clout but have never worked in the business, saying that this is just the worst thing. I mean, going back to the early stands of the race with the Ferraris and Mercedes changing positions, I love that. I thought the Ferraris were cooked when George Russell got past and then Leclerc got back by him again. Like, I had never seen that in a while, but you have people comparing this to, like, remember the Formula E race in Portland where there was so much happening that we thought that this jumped the shark? I mean, not to play devil's advocate like any other mediocre white man, but how is this different?
I think there's a couple of things you got to consider. First of all, we just come off the back of a qualifying session where Mercedes put 8 tenths on the rest of the field. So we thought automatically that Mercedes were going to just completely drive off and dominate this race. They didn't, in all fairness. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. Is that I think a lot of people saw that fight as a pleasant surprise. Because of the fact that I don't think a lot of people expected Ferrari to be competitive right out of the traps of that race. And you make a fair point in terms of the nature of the passing. Like, the difference is in Portland, that was going through the entire field because in Formula E, battery management is everything in that series. It is the first foremost, it is the most important thing when you watch Formula E is that you have to battery manage the entire race. You don't necessarily have to do that in Formula One. Even with this regulation set, it's a bit it's a bit more simplified than that. Like,
and the Formula E comps were coming out crazy. in this race, not just when Max Verstappen dropped that.
Yeah, it's been since preseason testing. It's like, oh, it's Formula E. It's Formula E on steroids. And like, do people watch Formula E? Because we did for a long time, and I promise you, it is not the same. You know, like, David Coulthard mentioned Peloton racing one time on a commentary box, so enough on TV, and I almost cringed into oblivion. So I was like, uh-oh, not that word, not the P word. But no, it's for me, I can understand that to a degree, but I've always said, what's a natural overtake? A natural overtake, in inverted commas, if we're talking about artificial passing, because we've had quote unquote artificial passing since 2010. Yeah. Since we had DRS debut in 2011. And what about Kurs? We had Kurs for a good while beforehand.
Yeah, I can't believe that all this discourse has made us nostalgic for the days of DRS. Not like I didn't mind DRS, but
it was a necessary evil because we were developing cars that were generating more and more topside downforce, generating more and more dirty air on track. So you had to do something to mitigate that because we all thought the floor of the car and moving downforce around was off limits. So as a compromise, we had DRS. And for the most part, it worked. It's just, it doesn't feel like a good enough overtake because you used your rear wing being open. Because again, it's all about the vibes.
Right.
And trust me, if it was all about the vibes, we would have 10 overtakes of Grand Prix.
But there would be real overtakes, as some host of Fifth Gear would say.
And I love Tiff. I love Tiff so much, but he's got some very antiquated takes on Formula One, which is disappointing for a guy that actually briefly raced in it. But no, look, you're never going to be able to convince the people that have this sort of vibes-based mantra that this is what you want to see. But a lot of it is the sport compromising. Like, it's, as I've always said on this show, you have to strike a balance between sporting integrity and entertainment. You can't have it totally one way or the other. You can't. You've got to compromise in certain elements because, as I've always said, if your sport is boring, it will die because no one will watch it and you don't make money.
And to the point where it's just like, what about racing back in the 70s, 80s, you know? That was real racing with real overtakes, no gimmicks needed. And yeah, they were right to an extent, but also that was back in an era where Formula One cars certainly were not bulletproof. Races could be won by margins of multiple laps at a time, and that's just not entertaining in 2020 terms.
Yeah, like, some people calling this like the peak of sadness over this regulation set, and if you want to be real for a minute here, and this is no bite against him, Max Verstappen won 19 Grand Prix in a 22-race season less than 2.5 years ago. And this is the pinnacle of sadness for you. You'd rather have, like, do you really want to bring 2023 back? Do you really want to bring that back? I swear to God.
Vettel was escaping DRS range
on the opening lap.
On the opening lap of his ultimate peak of power at Red Bull. Like, 2014, like the last time we rocked up to a new regulation set and Mercedes dominated. Mercedes was soft pedaling it because they could have gone harder if they wanted to, and they would have gotten hammered even further. And it created the greatest dynasty. How many times are we nostalgic in the moment about Michael Schumacher dropping 3 seconds a lap on everybody's heads, turning a 300-kilometer sprint into 475-kilometer super ultra mega sprints?
Funny that, because we've got sprints now and we hate them, apparently, even though we had no problem doing it when a guy in red turned the Grand Prix into them. It's amazing how these things turn out. He's a dickhead and he's a scumbag, but if there's one thing that I do agree with Vincent Kennedy McMahon on, it's that sometimes as an audience, we do not know what we want. And unfortunately, that's what leads to battleground conversations about this. And I find it, once again, very irritating that we live in a sporting climate where if you thought that Sunday's race was entertaining, you're a DTS fan, whatever the fuck that means.
Right. I've been watching Formula One for 25 years of my life over across multiple eras, and like, I know I didn't get those words thrown at me, but there are a lot of people that have been watching as long as I have, if not a little bit shorter, that have had that thrown at me because they didn't agree with what the general consensus was.
Yeah, like if you're an old school fan, how could you possibly enjoy this? Because entertainment is subjective. Like, that's
right.
Ultimately what this boils down to. Everybody's got their own idea of what
Formula One fandom is. Formula One is censoring dissent on their Twitter page. Never mind that's automatically managed by Etz, and they don't even do a good job at that.
No. To be fair, the FIA is being quite sensitive towards criticism, but that's from within the sport itself, because the drivers don't like this. To which I say, have the drivers ever liked a regulation set?
Never. Not unless it's in the past, right?
Right.
I'm sure Max Verstappen loves the last regulation set and the one before that. Not this one. Lewis Hamilton, I know for damn sure he didn't like that ground effect regulation set. He probably likes this more because so far it hasn't been a total disappointment for him.
Yeah, one dude who was like, I like this. This is fun. I was like, yeah, because he's competitive again. He wasn't that bad last year, but, you know, he looks a lot better this year so far.
Yeah, he looks most more like the Lewis Hamilton of old than an old washed up Lewis Hamilton was.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, 2 tenths off in qualifying, so a little bit behind. That's about what he was last year, but much better in race trim, was able to follow Leclerc pretty much the whole way through, and then was actually a lot quicker at the end of the race, to the point where I don't know how much of it was Leclerc just taking it easy, making sure the car was getting home, because it was a pretty much locked in third place, but Hamilton pretty much followed him home going over the finish line. If nothing else, pleasantly surprised by Ferrari in this one. I thought they were going to be further off than what they actually were in race trim. They weren't a million miles away.
After qualifying, I was giving up. And that might be another reason to this, is that we're facing the proposition of a season that looks like it's one-way traffic, especially after qualifying. Kimi Antonelli dropped half a second on Isaac Hadjar in a car that was just patched up during qualifying session, right?
Scary. I, as soon as I saw that in qualifying, I was like, oh, this could be a very long year. And I was like, because Russell on pole was not a huge shock. Like, that was pretty much what the form book had suggested from the top of the weekend, was that Russell was the quickest guy here. But on a stock setup, Antonelli, off a car that was rebuilt in 2.5 hours, which, again, incredible job by the Mercedes mechanics and pit crew to pull that off, to get him out there and get him through. But the fact he was half a second quicker than anybody else in any other car at that point was arguably scarier than Russell's 1/8 margin, because Antonelli was not a particularly great qualifier last year, head to head, and he smoked the rest of the field. And yeah, fair play to Cameron Buckley. He was adamant from the middle of last year that Mercedes were going to be this. And
well, Skip Buckley was also adamant not too long ago that Mercedes had such bad correlation issues that they'd never be able to dig themselves out of the development hole that they started themselves in 2022. Never mind that he also said that McLaren had no hope until they eventually turned around by introducing upgrade, because again, Formula One is one long giant development race.
It's Mercedes, funny how these things
out. Funny how all of this works out. And like, after the first pit stop, like, it's a wrap, dog. And like, oh, you just got to wonder, what if Ferrari brought, they could have split strategies. They could have brought in one of their cars to cover off the virtual safety car. Didn't have to bring in two, didn't have to do a double stack, but you just think, man, how different is the middle stanza of that race if Ferrari is shadowing Mercedes on the same strategy? Lewis was begging for it.
I mean, it's a weird one in hindsight, because if you ask Fred Vasseur and Charles Leclerc after the race, they both pretty much said that the win was never really on in the end. And I'm inclined to agree, because they had the advantage on tyres and they just could not make any inroads on Mercedes in open air anyway. So they were probably right to think that Mercedes probably had a little bit more in reserve. But for me, and this is this is a classic case of it's a minor haunting. So I don't think the win was ever on. I think what they got was ultimately the best they
could have got. All we missed out on was the opportunity for Dre Harrison to bring back the church.
I did promise my brother last week, if he knows didn't mean missed it, I did promise my brother I would bring back the church if Ferrari won the opening race. Sorry, church is closed. A valiant effort, I must say. No,
whatever in Devon's brick fund will have to go somewhere else.
Oh dear, it's almost like I'm not going to admit that I'm like bricked up on the podcast or something like that, but no. It's if nothing else, it was nice to see that Ferrari were able to at least punch Russell in the mouth.
Yeah.
Because again, as the form book suggested, they were lightning fast off the line. They've got smaller turbos than their competitors, yeah. which means it's easier for them to get to their biting point, and it's easier to spool up their turbo off the line because we have no MGUH. And they flew. Leclerc goes down in the turn one, leads the race, and then we get that ding dong battle early on. But like I said, I think ultimately, I don't think the win was ever on, but. Mm-hmm. I think, as my mate Sasha would say on the pod, you got to make them work for it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the key for me. Like, if Mercedes have been through enough over the years, it's that we know that they struggle most when they have to manage two cars at the same time. They are very good when they're in a comfortable 1-2 and the lead guy's comfortably in front because Antonelli had a bad start, so they could manage George first and foremost, and then they had to eat a double stack when the VSC came in and what have you. But Mercedes has struggled in years past strategically when they've had to juggle two cars. So like I said, make Mercedes work for it. You might be able to force a mistake.
Possibly. I mean, right now, and the form book suggests that they have such a clear advantage over everybody else that they're really, really, really going to have to work for it, or Mercedes is just going to have to make a mistake of its own volition so bad that they can't dig out of it. I was at least encouraged by what Ferrari could have given. Man, it could have been a little bit more, at least for a little bit longer in the race, man. There's a lot of missed opportunities. Mm. Like Oscar Piastri.
Ooh.
Oscar Piastri could have had it could have had a podium out of this. He could have had a podium out of this day.
I'm not convinced on that, only because if you look at Lando Norris's race, Lando was 50 seconds off the win, which, I mean, if Mercedes are the team to beat, I think Mercedes, on a quick tangent side note here, Mercedes holding back on what makes their power unit truly tick and how it works and correlates with the rest of their car is going to be priceless information in the first half of this season, because like Andrea Stella made it abundantly clear that we need to figure out how this power unit and how this correlates with our car really well, because he openly admitted they're like a second. He reckons they're a second off the pace, somewhere between three quarters and a full second off. And if Lando Norris's 50 second deficit was anything to go by, he's probably right. So
and this is where me and Cam disagree, because like he was certain and played out like this that Mercedes was going to have this advantage and keep all their trade secrets secret from their customers. Mm. And I'm just here thinking, but McLaren is the two-time and reigning world constructors champions. They're not going to fall off that easily. And as it turns out, it's not a total fall off, but you never want your one car that actually starts the race to finish 50 seconds down on everybody else.
And to be fair, I think that's across the board for all the Mercedes customers, because Williams was nowhere in this race. They were never really in contention. But their car is allegedly 30 kilos overweight, which is worth about a second a lap.
And you're not cutting those 30 kilograms by just going into the sauna until you pass out.
No. So, no, it's very MMA of you. No, but I fully agree that, you know, I can understand both sides of what you guys were saying in the sense of, like, I probably underestimated just how valuable that information was to McLaren in the grand scheme of things. But also, McLaren have been the gold standard of the field. They've been whooping the factory team's ass for the last 3 years now. And they've hijacked
a bunch of Red Bull. And this is in spite of themselves at times, right? Mm. How many times have we talked about papaya rules and self-sabotage?
many, many times. And, you know, give McLaren their due. They've built an outstanding racing team of a lot of the all-star players from other teams, like Rob Marshall, like Peter Prodromo, etc., etc. They've yanked a bunch of really good dudes. Hell, they got Will Courtenay in as well for strategy, because that was a big weakness of theirs last year. So, they've ticked a lot of those boxes. But we clearly underestimated just how valuable that knowledge of the power unit ended up being.
Yeah.
And it shows with Lando, who did not enjoy that race at all. And then, but at least he made it to the race, because Oscar Piastri crashed on the sighting lap. And
odd one. Like, he's coming through 3 and 4. He dips a wheel onto the curb at sitting turn 4 and then just revs it and spins right into the wall on the left hand side. And Oscar Piastri's day is done. And the number of surrender cobras going up in the grandstands around Melbourne, I don't even think they could get their arms behind their shoulders. I think they were just stunned silent. I don't blame them.
I had a friend of mine who was in that grandstand as it went down, and I got a text on Facebook Messenger about half an hour before the race going, "Dre, what the fuck just happened?" Because she was looking for information, because obviously she hasn't got like the TV feeds that we do. So she was hoping that I knew more. And I'm like, man's just buried it and put it in the wall. I mean,
no, like, friend and longtime patron of the show, Emma Cabello, like, messaged us in our Discord that Oscar Piastri crashed, and I thought she was joking.
So did I. I was like, what?
And then she was busy doing something else, and then I flip it on, and it's just like, oh, Oscar's crashed. Oh, that's a big one. He's not going to start the race. The curse continues. Like,
full credit, and you can see the behind the scene video of it now from a good friend of mine and former WTF1 head, Jess Medland, who's now a producer for Sky Sports F1. She showed the behind the scenes footage. They had the camera angle of when it happened, and then the rampage of, like, we got a break here, we got a break here, we got to cut to the producer, we got to cut to Crofty here as it happened. Outstanding TV production work to be able to cut to that as quick as they did. But yeah, startling stuff. Allegedly, I mean, Zach was very tight-lipped about what it could have been. He didn't want to give away anything. Piastri said in his media debrief afterwards that he claims that there was an extra 100 kilowatts coming out of the power unit when he put his foot down coming out of turn 4. That he wasn't prepared for, and that's what led to him just losing the car and then spinning into the outside wall, having lost control. Whether that's true or whether he's covering for himself, I don't know. I'm inclined to believe drivers when they say these sorts of things. I don't just assume that you're going to lie, because I think that's just bad faith. It wouldn't be the first really confusing crash that we had over the course of the weekend, because, like, we saw Antonelli's FP3 crash not really make a whole leap of conventional sense. Seemingly just got it on a bumper, maybe had a bit of a power spike. Well, I'm not sure on that one. And Verstappen's crash in qualifying was very weird. You don't normally see a car's entire rear axle lock up. That never happens. And I know it's probably the brake-by-wire system and the energy that's going through it to stop these cars. But again, when was the last time you saw Max Verstappen make a driver error on that sign, on that kind of scale? Like, to the point where he's binned it out of a session entirely. He never does that. So,
maybe in terms of racing other people, but not on his own and not like that.
No.
But I'll say this. Verstappen did well to recover from the back of the grid to finish sixth.
Mm-hmm.
And up until his power unit failure, Isaac Hadron was looking so good. I know it's one race. I know Yuki Tsunoda had a good first race, and then it all went to shambles. But am I wrong for thinking, Dre, that something might be different here because it's different people running Red Bull? And because there's less pressure on them to perform? Like, okay, it's not as bad as all the doomsayers about Ford Racing's power units were saying it was going to be. But the expectation right now is not that they're going to challenge for a driver's and constructor's title.
No, and I think Red Bull have laid that out very clearly from pre-season testing. They've always said, we think we're the fourth best team. And they've been very upfront about that. Pierre Wachet said that pretty much from the top. Lauren Mekki said that during the Australian Grand Prix weekend. They think they're fourth best right now. And, well, if the form book was anything to go by, they are probably correct in that they're probably either third or fourth, depending on how they get down with McLaren. I think that's about right. I'll say this much. I think that was a great weekend for Mizak Aja. I think that was a really, really good first weekend. Third in qualifying was exceptional to beat a lot of very, very capable elite level talent in similar machinery, i.e. Piastri, Norris, Leclerc, Hamilton. He out-qualified all of them. You know, that's a very impressive, you know, first effort in this car. And he was running in a comfortable P5 when his car died. It probably would have been a top five finish if it wasn't for that. As it's now, I don't know how much of that is lower expectations. I don't know how much of that is the fact that Horner and Marco are gone, and therefore it's a little bit less toxic, so we just feel a little bit better about it. Again, maybe the vibes works both ways. I don't know. But I think Hadja showed in one weekend more impressive resilience and more impressive racing speed and racecraft than we got pretty much all year from Yuki Tsunoda last year and a couple of the Red Bull guys that have come before it. And the only issue I have is that he hasn't had any direct running against Max, because we didn't know how Max could have qualified in Q3. And of course, Max was coming from the back in the race itself before Hadja's car died, so we didn't really get a direct comparison. But if he's going to be hovering around P5 all year long, he'll be absolutely fine. That's exactly what they've needed the whole time.
They haven't had that since about half of Sergio Perez's tenure at Red Bull. Even then, that was under scrutiny because Verstappen was winning all the time and Perez wasn't challenging the way Nico Rosberg challenged Lewis Hamilton.
Yeah, the luxury. We want not only a dominant car, but we also want two elite level drivers virtually within 2/10 of each other. Do you know how rare that is?
That's a unicorn, dog. Like, Rubens Barrichello, in hindsight, was probably better equipped. He had no chance against Michael Schumacher, pace wise and probably politics wise. But it's you can't have one without the other, man. I don't know, but I just want to see Hadger replicate this in China and throughout the season. I think that'll give us a better tell of where things stand. A couple really impressive performances as well. Am I wrong to think that Arvid Lindblad was unlucky to only finish eighth on his Formula One debut? He qualified ninth, got a good enough start, got passed by cars that you expect to be quicker than the Racing Bulls Red Bull Ford, but got points out of it. Performed demonstrably better than Liam Lawson, although Lawson had his own issues that weren't of his control. This is what people expected of Arvid Lindblad.
I think he was alongside Kimi for driver of the weekend for me. I mean, if there's one positive we can definitely take out of the weekend, is that the midfield bar fight is back.
Man.
We had 8 different teams scored a point over this race weekend, and we'll run that down in a minute. But for me, Arvid Lindblad, first Grand Prix weekend of asking, was, and if you look at the practice times, he was pretty much top 10 the whole weekend. He was looking like a definite Q3 runner all the way through, and he was. He made Q3, not great in a final qualifying lap. I think he made a mistake somewhere, but He was running fourth at one point. He had a great start. And again, I don't think the Racing Bulls is on the level of the big four, as we know. I think Racing Bulls, Audi, Haas, and Alpine are all pretty close together, which is going to lead to a lot of fun fights in the midfield, potentially battling for minor points. But Lindblad was very impressive. And even if you ignore Lawson's poor start and Franco Colapinto's super fuming near miss off the grid to avoid his slow-moving car, because holy shit. You know when George Russell's looking like the Surrender Cobra? It's like, oh my God. You know, something was up there.
But it just goes to show that, like, the bottom tier of Formula One drivers now are so much better than the bottom tier drivers from the days that, especially after this weekend, we are all so nostalgic for.
Absolutely. Like, you know, like Franco Colapinto pisses all over someone like a Yuji Ide or an Alex Jung. No disrespect to them. But, like,
Yeah, that's two Super Formula legends you're dissing, man. Franco Colapinto could be one soon. You never know. Jack Doohan, well, let's not. Eileen Lawson was.
The key thing for me to note was Lindblad was comfortably quicker than Liam Lawson all weekend.
Yeah.
That was... Lawson was stuffed in a locker over the course of the weekend, and I already had concerns about Lawson going into the year. If Lindblad's this good out of the box, then Lawson's going to be in for tough justification to keep his seat, because, like, it turns out that maybe that dickhead Helmut Marko left Red Bull with one last parting gift, and that was Arvid Lindblad, because this kid looks quick.
Well, I could have left him with one more, and now it's done, but then Red Bull decided we don't need him, and we also don't need you. We're fine rolling with Nikola Solov as number one on the Red Bull Junior Team prospect chart. And look, it worked out great this weekend, got the feature race dub, but like... The only thing that's saving Lawson right now is that I don't think Solov is ready for prime time just yet.
Well, as you said, he did take the F2 feature race win pretty comfortably. I mean, in a race of balmy decisions and crazy racecraft, it was the Formula 3 graduates that had the coolest head, because it was Nikita Solov and Rafael Kamara 1 and 2 in that race, which I think is funny. And look, Solov... He's not well liked on the internet scene for obvious and understandable reasons. The man's quick. He walked into Formula 2 at the back end of last year and was running top 6 straight away. He's fast. There's no doubt about that. I don't think it will be his only feature race win of this season. He's fast. Rafael Kamara, I think, is also as quick as advertised. Uh-huh. They're going to be at the thick end of things. Yeah. No doubt about it.
Kira makes a good point. Kira, not the biggest Nikola Solov fan, but makes a good point. He's quick, and he's lost his hot-headedness. He's dangerous, which is what could become of Alex Dunn if he just solved the second portion of it.
For those who have not seen it, it is horrendously bad racecraft in the sense of he's racing his... this is his teammate, Martini Estenshorn, he's racing against.
Your teammates.
And he's gone around the outside of the main straight towards turn one to pass him. He's got the move done. He's got 95% of his car in front. And then he turns into Stenshorn's lane and then brake tests him.
While they were running 1-2, and that's your teammate, and I know Alex Dunn is better than that. Alex Dunn could be number one on the Red Bull Junior Team prospect chart and giving Liam Lawson a real reason to sweat. But he's not. He's at Alpine, right? I just worry about his temperament. Like
I've said before, and I'll say again, I think on raw speed, he's the fastest man in the junior scene right now. He's got enough pace where he can win 50% of the races on the board, but he can't get out of his own way. And that's it angers me because I don't want to see talent wasted.
Uh-huh.
And that's what he's doing right now by shitless. Yeah. And the worst part was he got out of that car and immediately thought that Stenshorn was to blame, which is laughable. Laughable how out of touch you are. I think he's been given a grid penalty and 2 penalty points for the next feature race weekend, which now puts him at 14 over the last calendar year.
Yeah. And 14. And the only reason why he doesn't have a race ban is because they clean slate your penalty points at the end of the season. It's not over a rolling 1 year period.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I'm just
5 days grid penalty for Monaco.
Yeah. just to wrap up this Formula 2 potion. I'm just glad that experience counts. P4 in the standings. Maybe there is hope after all that we will not leave Formula 2 completely sad and without a race win that other lesser drivers have. Anyway, Gabriel Bortoleto for Audi. Finishing ninth. Again, this far exceeding the most pessimistic projections for what Audi was going to be going into Formula One. It started with Bortoleto getting into Q3. Hülkenberg wasn't far off. Qualifying 11th doesn't start the race due to a technical problem, which, man, if both Audis had just been able to start the race, that could have been a really, really good first weekend for them.
I think it's probably double points if Hülkenberg actually takes the grid. As I just said on the record, I'm a big Jonathan Wheatley guy. This guy knows what he's doing. I'm a huge fan of what he's done since he joined Kicksalver as team principal. This is a really solid looking team. And Audi's, again, they've been very pessimistic about themselves. They've gone about it the right way in that they've played down expectations. They were like, listen, we don't know how good we are until we actually race this car. I think Hülkenberg very funnily put it, well, we don't know until everybody puts their trousers down. And then we find out how quick these cars actually are.
Nico Hülkenberg.
That is extremely dad-coded Nico Hülkenberg humor. But, you know, Gabriel Bortoleto made Q3 on merit, first time of asking, brand new power unit in the car, brand new car in general. And then Hülkenberg was less than a tenth away from making it. But Hülkenberg was the man eliminated by Bortoleto's final quick lap. You know, and he was less than a tenth behind. It's pretty much a carbon copy that they've been throughout all of 2025 as well. They're very, very evenly matched in qualifying. But Bortoleto was, yeah, he was on a rampage his final stint. He was coming down, cutting through everybody on quicker tires on his final stint, and he almost got up to P8. Like, really, really impressive race from Gabriel Bortoleto. Again, if he stays out of his own way in terms of racecraft, he's going to score points a lot more frequently this year because he's very, very quick. The speed is absolutely there with him. Great debut round. Obviously gutted that Hülkenberg couldn't make the grid. They were very upset about that. I think James Key didn't want to go into a lot of detail about it. I think he reckons it might have been an ignition problem with the car. And when you're on the grid and you can't start it, you've got to get yanked out. There's no way of getting around it. It's a shame because, again, reliability is always a bitch. But really, really promising first weekend.
Yeah. Audi had a good weekend that kind of continues their upward trend. Cadillac, well, it's a from scratch effort. It kind of looked like a from scratch effort, but hey, it could always be worse, Ray. It's now time to go gawk at the wreckage on the other side of the freeway, and it's green and it's a bloody mess. Aston Martin Honda, as predicted, did not finish the race. Both their cars retired from the race, and not just that, but Lance Stroll didn't set a representative time. He didn't technically qualify, got dispensation to start because Alonso did set a representative time, and Stroll also has 10 years of Formula One experience. Wow.
Oh, man.
Ultimately, it doesn't matter because both of them retire, but Trey, we alluded to this at the top of the show. There's even more to the nonsense that we weren't all that aware of. Or at least didn't make a huge fuss of before.
We've joked about this on this show many a time that sometimes when you record, you miss a big news story. It happens every once in a while. As I was publishing our Haters Guide to the F1 season, there was Thursday morning a sit down media session with Adrian Newey, team principal, yep, and Kojie Watanabe, the head of HRC. That's Honda Racing Corporation, for those who don't know. And Adrian Newey pretty much admitted that the car was not safe to drive. Basically admitted that because of the amount of vibration that the power unit and chassis in tandem was causing, Alonso reckoned he could only drive for 25 laps. Otherwise, he'd be risking permanent nerve damage. So in other words, welcome to Games Done Quick. I'm here for a carpal tunnel, any percent speed run.
Fernando Alonso, who, by the way, according to urban legend, many people believe was once electrocuted during the last time he drove with Honda power units during Barcelona testing.
Want to see me do it again? And Lance Stroll was even worse. Stroll reckoned he could only handle 15 laps, which I think is a throwback to the wrist injury.
He had the wrist injury that he gritted through, right?
Mm. And, you know, the one he had to pull out of the Spanish Grand Prix with last year because, again, it was in so much pain he couldn't race on it. So in other words, Newey had basically admitted that the car was not fit to drive.
Yeah.
That they were not expecting to finish the Grand Prix and that, you know, they were going to continue to work on this and get it right. But then he also said something quite strange in the sense of he also thought they had a top five chassis. And I reckon they were only about 0.75 to a second off the leading group, which says to me, and I made a video short about this on our TikTok pages, is Newey already throwing Honda under the bus? Because it feels like they're throwing Honda under the bus.
Yeah, that's very strange considering all the visits that Aston Martin has made to Honda Racing Corporation within the last 3 years. Stop. Wait a second. Hold on. I'm getting the word that that may not be the understanding of how things actually went down.
Again, according to Adrian Newey, he claimed on Friday that they were only made aware of Honda's depleted investment into the Formula One team and the lack of staff that they had at the time in November of last year, because no one had checked on the Honda partnership until they had a sit-down visit November in 2025. So in other words, less than 6 months ago. Just a reminder, the Honda Aston Martin deal was agreed back in the middle of 2023. So with that in mind, if what Newey is saying is true, and I'm not entirely sure, because let's not forget Newey didn't even join the team officially until March last year. In other words, has the communication been that bad between Honda and Aston Martin since this deal was formally announced back in 2023? Because something seems missing here. This doesn't make any sense. Are you mean to tell me that you've basically not visited headquarters for Honda at all in the nearly 3 years you've had this partnership? What's going on?
It's one thing to throw Adrian Newey under the bus because of his exalted record as a designer and in getting... having a pretty tough job his first time as team principal, but like, what's the excuse for everybody else that was at Aston Martin before he brought on Adrian Newey as team principal?
You know what's funny about this? The timing is kind of funny. They said November 2025, right? What prolific member of Aston Martin's team allegedly handed in their notice to leave in that same month?
Would that have been Andy Cowell?
Andy Cowell, the CEO of the team, who was allegedly moved into a new role when they announced that Newey was going to be team principal, to be a chief strategic officer and a liaising with Honda. So now we know, because of the company's house information in the UK, that Cowell tried to resign and was off the board of directors in December of last year. So it seems that there was, I mean, from what Andrew Benson at the time, because he broke the story last year when this first came to pass, the claim was that there was dissension between Newey and Cowell because nobody knew who was actually in charge. So this seems like, it feels like a piece of the story is missing. It feels like, again, as I've always said on this show, you get person A story, you get person B story, and then you get the truth. So, and I feel like there's parts of this story that are blatantly missing, because this feels like a huge amount of miscommunication between both major entities that have led to not only a very disappointing Honda pairing at the start of 2026, but also dissension in the Aston Martin camp as they tried to get their ducks in a row to organize this supposed super team.
And it's a much different Honda from what it was back then. I know people will just say it's a much different Honda because Takahiro Hachigo quit Formula One for no good reason. No, he probably got scared because of all the forecast of what life was going to be like in the era of the novel coronavirus, and that made him pull the plug on Honda's power units. And by the time they recommitted, all the old Honda people, or at least a lot of them, are working with Red Bull powertrains, which is aligned with an entirely different OEM now. It's all new people. Honda Racing is now a unified brand. They're handling all the two-wheel stuff, all the four-wheel stuff. You're developing a new IndyCar engine formula. You're developing a new top-class prototype for IMSA and maybe WEC. We don't know. And now you're having to divert all those resources that you were using to rejuvenate the MotoGP program, potentially, They have to bring them in to try and fix what's wrong with the Formula One side.
It's a hot mess. The whole, I mean, this was, again, credit to Jonathan Noble at the race. He was the first guy to report that at the start of the year, that this was not the same Honda that we knew from 2021. This was a depleted Honda. This was a fragmented Honda, because, again, a lot of people have moved over to Red Bull permanently to work on the powertrain. A lot of them have moved on to their IndyCar and IMSA projects. And a lot of them were helping to, and the real crown jewel of HRC, the MotoGP team, which was in dire straits after Marc Marquez left them in the end of 2023. It was horrendous. For those who don't know their bikes, Honda are in desperate ways in MotoGP towards a couple of years ago. And the latest we're getting from that now, as RJ alluded to, Yuri Puigdemont, one of the best, probably the best MotoGP journo in the biz, is reporting that Honda are going to pull people from the MotoGP team over to the F1 team to try and fix this problem. Because in the Grand Prix itself, according to the team statement, the moment Aston Martin realized they weren't going to score points, they parked the cars, and then they basically treated it like it was a test session. Lance Stroll did finish the Grand Prix, but he was 15 laps down, so technically he wasn't a finisher.
He's a non-classified finisher. What was the point other than to gather data?
I found out the other day that was the first time someone's a non-classified finisher that was 15 laps down since 2004. Takuma Sato at BAR Honda, ironically also a Honda engine car. Not great. But it's the form book is as expected. If there's one thing they can take away from all this, it's that in qualifying trim, Alonso wasn't a million miles away. Probably 2.5 to 3 seconds. It's not quite as bad as what they were saying in preseason testing.
Yeah.
But no one was here for this. Uh-huh. People were talking about Aston Martin as a top four threat. Adrian Newey is still talking like they're a top four threat. And that's part of the problem. Because now we're clearly in a scenario where Newey thinks his chassis is brilliant and that Honda are holding them back. And I'm sitting here going, you're responsible for this shit.
Where have I heard this story before?
And we watched preseason testing. The issues were far beyond the power units. Like, the gearbox was shit. The cooling was shit. The old Newey trait of the packaging was arse. Like, this is not... this. Anyone who thinks this is purely on Honda is chugging some hopium.
It is an everything problem.
Nothing about this race car is good. Nothing. They're down on power, they're down in acceleration, they're not great through the corners, contrary to what Newey believes, and they are they're at least 2.5 seconds off where they need to be, in my opinion. And the worst part is there's already teasings of dissension amongst this camp, which is just a bad look for everybody involved.
Oh, don't worry, it's not like Fernando Alonso has a reputation of being disruptive, particularly in his early days. You said that if this was a good car, that he'll retire. What if it's this for the rest of 2025? Is he going to want to stick around for this? Hell no!
I don't know. Like, the man's finally settled down with a long-term partner. He's 45 later this summer.
44.
You know.
He is 45. Shit.
Yeah. Like I said, first 45-year-old in F1 since Graham Hill, if he makes it that far. That was 1973. Allegedly misses his pregnancy, so could be about to become a dad for the first time. Like, I don't know how much longer he wants to stick this out, because for me, I think Aston Martin look at least 2 years away, minimum.
So, and if you're Aston Martin right now, are you going to be snapping at heels to try and get in his seat if Alonso does somehow step away? I don't know, dog.
Yeah, like, if Alonso walks away at the end of the year, who takes that seat?
I mean, the obvious Jack answer Crawford? For a lot of people is just like, what, Jack Crawford? Does Honda give Yuki Tsunoda a U-up test?
Oh God! Could you imagine? It's like Yuki. Something's come up. you know, there might be an opening for you to get back on the grid. Downside, it's Aston Martin.
Ooh, not what we expected, but.
We don't have much time because we've got to turn around right away, and you've got to pull another all-nighter weekend because it's a Chinese Grand Prix at Shanghai next. Another place with long straightaways, another place where I am 100% certain there will be more discourse about super clipping, battery management, etc. Is this what we want Formula One to be? I need to see a little bit more first before I come to the total conclusion that this is completely new and different from the Formula One that I've watched. Because the second half of the Australian Grand Prix looked very, very familiar what I've seen years past.
I'll take the role of Cameron Buckley here briefly and say the one big problem potentially with this regulation set isn't necessarily the battery management, isn't necessarily the super clipping. It's the fact that because we have flat floors again, all the downforce is topside. Again, and that means dirty air machines all over again. And that could be a big problem, especially when you combine that with the fact we now have active aero, so we now basically have no slipstream effect because all that drag is now going in a straight line. So, as I mentioned in my TikTok when I talked about it, I said this format does have potential with tweaks. I think the chief solution that the FIA should probably consider is you turn the deployment output down from the 350 kilowatts that it is right now. I think 300 to 250, is the sweet spot. Have a battery that can last longer as opposed to one that's more powerful and is shorter. Take the power output down a little bit and maybe that can compromise it. But I will say this, it is a sprint weekend that could make the sprint more interesting. That could be something to look forward to because this is a sprint weekend in China. And if we get an 11 to 13 lap blitz like we got in Australia, that could be fun. You know, it's something. But you're right. We do need a bigger sample size. I think that's the message across the board. We need a bigger sample size, and we need to see this at more tracks. Australia was never going to be the carbon footprint, no Matt Morgan, of what we want this formula to be. Like, Australia has always been a power-hungry track. It's a street track. It's very full throttle. China's a lot more technical. It's a lot twistier. There's a lot more low to medium speed corners there. I think we'll get a better example of what this could be on a more conventional circuit this weekend in China.
Absolutely. Or, you know, this could all just lead us down to a panic. Mohammed Ben Sulayem restores us back to naturally aspirated V8s with no hybrid, and everybody will suddenly love him again. I don't know, dog. Let's get the hell out of here.
Let's get out of here. Guys, thank you very much for listening and watching. We'll be back for another Formula One episode next time out in China. We've got IndyCar coming up next later on this week with the story so far. And, of course, there'll be another IndyCar episode next week as well as we review the Grand Prix of Arlington. We'll preview that a little bit as well in our IndyCar episode coming up. But until then, I've been Dre Harrison. He's been RJ O'Connell. Thank you very much for watching. And we'll catch you guys soon. Sayonara.
Later, y'all.
I haven't actually got a end of episode joke like Cam normally does at this point. That's actually really annoying.
I do. Damn. Actually. This is a Magic City that I'm sure everybody at the NBA will appreciate because Shanghai's the Magic City of China. Got him.